Okay. Mary asked me a question. The stranger I mentioned earlier had a medieval precedent of Mercurius, and I thought maybe not everyone knows who Mercurius was. It goes back to the Greek Hermes, who's the messenger. When Hermes got to Rome, he became Mercury. And that figure of Mercury, or Hermes, was taken up very strongly in alchemy. And there, they just gave him the name Mercurius. And he changed a little bit. The figure of Mercurius is dual. He's good and bad. He's matter and spirit. He's helpful and destructive. So Mary said, you know, is he related to the devil? Well, not directly, but he's not excluded. And it's a highly, thank you. It's a highly complicated, complex figure. And he, you know, Jung has a whole essay on him. And you basically come away saying, well, Mercurius to the alchemist meant everything. And because they consider him the beginning of the process, the end of the process, the means whereby you get from the beginning to the end. And he really does symbolize a dimension of the unconscious. So when we say the stranger had a precedent in Mercurius, for Pauli, that meant that this part of ourselves was once honored in the Middle Ages. But when science came in, all that stuff was excluded. So it's not that Mercurius isn't alive. He is still alive. It's just we don't know how to investigate him. So we'll come back to it. I just wanted to clarify who Mercurius was, if you're not familiar. You can get a cup. You want to get a cup of coffee?
The other thing with Hermes that him here is he was the only guy who could move between the upper and underworld
community. Right.
He encapsulated the whole thing. There was no place that he couldn't move. So that gives you an idea of why maybe he was the whole problem.
Yeah, and the right place, he can move between matter and spirit. Mm-hmm. He is that movement. Thank you. Wow. He is that movement between matter and spirit. Just a couple of words while you're doing that, just to give word to what I want to explain in the second paragraph there. He calls that the unitary aspect of existence. That matter and spirit don't operate separately. They are a unity, and you see their unity in a synchronicity. That's what science can't come to grips with.
The unitary, what is the next?
A unitary aspect of existence. I'm just giving buzzwords to what we've been talking about.
Okay. Thank you.
Another buzzword that he uses in the last paragraph on page 2 is the numinous background of our existence. It's what, fourth line up. Or fifth line up, depending on how you count. So from the right, fifth line up. Fourth line up. You miss back on the right. All that means is that, you know, there is something else going on in the world which is trying to guide us. And it's at the background of our existence. That's Sophia. And science can't recognize it. Again, you might say, why should science bother? Because the dreams seem to indicate that's what's necessary to keep science from being destructive, for it to evolve to a point where either it becomes a point of view that can understand this, or a new point of view is developed which subsumes science and can understand this. We don't really know. Another phrase that we'll see that Pauli is hounded because his knowledge of physics is uncommitted. That's in the second paragraph on page 2.
Hounded by the unconscious?
By the unconscious. That his grasp of physics is uncommitted. Now we got to figure out what committed physics is. It is just another word for what I have been saying, with a slight twist, maybe. We will see in the dreams that they constantly are having a dual focus. They're talking to Pali about his own problems. They're talking to Pali about the problems in the worldview he created and represents. And they're talking about how those two things are really the same. That he is a living example of the worldview he created. And there's something wrong with it. We'll be pursuing this at much greater length. But what the dreams are saying is, you know, Pali, you can make any... You as a scientist or science can make any sort of discovery, and it has no ethical obligation. How do you get to feeling responsible for what you have created? Well, that's... It's going to be the business of our dreams. I'm just opening up the question. There is a way, and that's something we'll be exploring. But as far as the unconscious is concerned, science, the problem with science is that it is an uncommitted knowledge.
So you're saying uncommitted means unethical?
That you don't... Yeah, I want to put it a little more cautiously, but that there are no ties to the way you live your life from what you've created. Just to give you, this sounds completely nonsensical, let me give you a quick bird's eye view of where we'll be going. Pali will be talking that scientific theories, which we say are rational, are actually preceded in dreams by images. That science is really preceded in the work of the creative scientist by these ideas appearing first as dream symbols. So before a certain theory is developed, you can follow that thought process in the creative scientist through their dream symbols, which precede and symbolize the idea that is going to be later discovered and made rational, but in fact it has a very non-rational origin. So that science is really the extrapolation of a myth. We will be seeing examples of that. This is not just talk. Pali was trying to work on this. Well,
have a new myth, right?
Maybe it's part of the new myth that's coming up. And it gets extrapolated into scientific theory. But what happened to the images that preceded it? That's one place that the dreams are going to be saying, we know how to work with symbols. So if you're developing a scientific theory and you are working with your dreams, you will see the pre-stages of that new worldview, that new scientific theory, appearing in your dreams as images. Well, we know how to take responsibility for images. So the way to a committed physics... A committed science is the scientists both work on the outer project and work on the dreams that are leading to that outer project and see them both as pointing to the external world and to the internal world. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole new way of looking at scientific creativity, that it is really not the observation of data and then the constructing of a theory in the mind. That all along in the unconscious is preparing that new understanding. And it's really the unconscious that creates that new theory. And before it becomes a theory, it's images. And those images we can work with subjectively. again, I'm saying, just giving you a lot of stuff to get started, give you an idea of the range of our discussion. But we will spend a couple weeks on that idea.
Is that not true? You call it dreams, and maybe other people call it other things, but like Edison, I know, said he got an image first, and then the discovery.
I think it's close. I don't know Edison that well. But see, what Pally did, he wrote an essay on this and took his dreams of some of the concepts that he created and showed their inter-psychic meaning. Intra-psychic meaning. Right.
Is that him?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Did you guys see
him yet? Summary of the essay. Some of the dreams.
Is it Einstein's relativity theory? He saw something traveling on light. It wasn't a dream. And that,
it was his fantasy, I think.
Was it a fantasy? It wasn't a night dream?
Somebody said, what do you want to do for the rest of your life? And he said, imagine what it's like sitting on a photon traveling at the speed of light.
But so he turned that image. And then who was the one that dreamt the Ouroboros?
Kekulé, the guy who discovered the carbon ring.
Wow,
yeah, you can now, if you know this now, you can go back to the scientific literature, which is something I may like to do at some point. You may like to do in your studies, and bring this up. But really, we have got a, and again, why I like Pally, I'm going to tell you what I like about him, and I'm going to tell you what I don't like about him. This is what I like about him. He had the guts to say this, that science is not rational. We think that what science does is rationally investigate data and reach conclusions, but how do you get from the data to the theory? The mind is working in there, and that mind is guided by the image. We don't know it because scientists are not working with dreams, but they should, he says. And if they could begin to do that, they would begin to see these scientific theories they are developing are preceded by images which have implications for the way they live their life. Like if you have an artist draws a picture, we know how to interpret a picture. But if a scientist develops a theory, how do you interpret a theory? You lose the personal relationship to the product, but not when you understand that a scientific theory is preceded by an image. It's like science is like a work of art that's just been extrapolated into thought. And it's got just as many images in it as art does. We just don't know it because scientists have not been paying attention to their unconscious. So that's the uncommitted physics. What's the difference between a committed and an uncommitted physics? Another way to say it is, you could say that, and we know how to help artists grow through their art. We could also help scientists grow through their science by working with the images beneath their scientific work.
So would that be the knowing something in that person?
Yes.
That's producing the dream?
Yes, okay. That would be the stranger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you can kind of disidentify from the world of consciousness and put yourself in the place of the unconscious and put yourself, we'll be seeing the stranger, and put yourself in the standpoint of that stranger, all the things we talk about to that stranger are just nonsense. There is no split between spirit and matter. There is no split between science and art. From where he is, all he sees is an image going out to the world, and it belongs everywhere. And then the question is, how do we get back to live that way? That's the question. And, as I say, Sophia will be his consort, because Sophia is that part of him which is residing in the material world, as we talked about. This intelligence of the material world. And the other thing that's going to come up is what this all has to do with Pally's sex life. It's going to get very personal. Because the way he loved is not separate here. All of this belongs together. So we will be seeing the relationship of the developments of science, the developments of his own personality, and the developments of his sexuality. And he fell in love with Erwin von Franz. That's what we'll be looking at, that relationship. And how it scared the bejeebies out of him, and what it was asking of him, what he could respond to and what he couldn't respond to. So it's going to be a kind of a holistic look at all facets of his life. personal, professional, scientific, historical, romantic, all of this is going to come into play. Because remember, for the stranger, there are no categories. There is just one image, which is asking something of us, and that stranger simply cannot understand, why do you guys split things up? The last line there on the forward, page 2, the alchemical spirit of matter, seemingly dead, struggles for its own resurrection. That's another way to say what I've just said. Very last line on page 2. And I have no idea what number 24, page 36 means. I'm racking my brains. Why did I put that there?
See, there's a typo there. I don't
know. Oh, there are a gazillion typos.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, if I didn't tell you, let me tell you, I know there are a gazillion typos.
Okay.
I did this at 3 o'clock in the morning most of the time. And I'm glad it's out. That's a nice and I'll be damn hung up with my spell checker on this thing. My next job is, after we discuss it here, is to go back and retype it, or not retype it,
right,
but edit it and then start sending it off to be proofed by some people who know German. Yeah, it's filled with typos.
Yeah,
No, it just depressed me.
Maybe you do have
the double one. Yeah, I know there are a lot of typos. Okay, you have a feeling for what we'll be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Why it's important, what we're doing, what the background of it is, and so on. Page 3. He's born in 1900 in Vienna. His dad was a doctor. I didn't know what colloid chemistry was. It's a branch of organic chemistry that investigates emulsions, basically, that will not fit through a certain diameter screen. Organic. He's an organic chemist, put it very simply. The father was born in Prague, and he moved to Vienna. And what is so important there is that he was Jewish, but he disavowed his Judaism. And Wolfgang never knew that till he was 18. He was half Jewish. The mother was Catholic, and it sounds like earthy. The father was an intellectual, and the mother was less artificial. I don't know if you know Austrians, but they tend to be jolly and somewhat peasant. I don't mean peasant in a negative way, but comfortable with natural impulses. They tend to be friendly and jolly and boisterous and so on. Not the irritating boisterousness of a German, but a kind of happiness in them. You see, by the way, there's a split between the maternal material and the paternal spiritual. So, like I said, we're going to be working on several dimensions, because as far as the stranger is concerned, there is no such thing as dimensions, but we have to slice the world up like that. So we'll be looking at the split in spirit and matter and the split in Wolfgang Pauli. And they are parallel. So Pauli is going to be the epitome of the split we're seeing in science. In his own personal life reflects the ills we're going to try to dissect and heal in our worldview. I guess the mother was a newspaper correspondent for apparently a liberal press in Vienna, Neue Freie Presse or New Free Press. And it sounds like it wasn't much of a marriage. from what I can tell. And that's what Pally ended up with, was not much of a marriage. They were pals, somebody told a friend of mine, he and his wife. And that's about it. Good friends, but I don't think it was a fire relationship. A big point is this guy, Ernst Mach, wrote a long picture. Ernst Mach was Wolfgang Pauli's godfather. Now, you know, like Mach 1, Mach 2? That's Mach. It's the same guy. And what Mach did was study the mechanics of what's the word, supersonic? No.
Supersonic?
Supersonic. Of supersonic motion. And what he, I think his big discovery was that there would be a sound boom. What do you call that?
Sonic
boom. At the speed of light. So he was a physicist and totally, totally rational. He developed a philosophy which is, or I don't know if he developed it, but he worked within a philosophy called logical positivism. Mm-hmm. And I think you probably know more about this than I do, Nancy, but my basic understanding of positivism is if you can't see it, it doesn't exist. It's very, it's the worldview of science narrowly understood. That, you know, there's no such thing as hunches. If you can't see it, you can't demonstrate it, it doesn't exist.
If it can't be quantified.
If it can't be measured, as a friend of mine, if it can't be measured, poked, and put in a box, it doesn't exist. So you see, this was a very strong influence on Pally from day one. His godfather. You can see kind of a, I think, you know, a very, very benevolent guy, but just still very much in that worldview, which is a reaction to the superstition of the Middle Ages, still. So you're going to see that Pally has this huge, logical, rational side. I guess I was reading one book. He told his first wife he got divorced, "You should like me because I'm a famous physicist." Isn't that romantic? Pally, I'm going down about half a page. Pally was a child genius. At the age of 19, he wrote articles on relativity, meaning he completely understood it. I heard somebody say that they thought, or it was the general consensus, that just intellectually, Pally was smarter than Einstein. He was enormously brilliant. Probably the most, in terms of just raw intellectual power, if not the one of the most brilliant scientists of his day. So you can see what that puts on a man, that degree of intellectual brilliance was something he struggled with all the time. And then, of course, a corresponding weakness in the area of feeling. Well, that's like all I'll say about his biography. Basically, Viennese, half Jewish, denied his Jewish heritage until he was a teenager. His parents, on one side earthy, on the other side intellectual, a very strong influence from Ernst Mach. And a just a simple brilliance in its own right, intellectual, scientific brilliance. He had one sister born, I think, 8 years later. And he liked to carouse. He was a big carouser. Einstein. Let's take a little bit of time to talk about Einstein. As we go through the book, I'm going to try to weave in the scientific ideas of the time so you can have some appreciation for what was going on scientifically, just for its own sake, but also we're going to be treating these scientific facts as metaphors. So I know I discussed with some of you the basics of relativity. Shall I go over it again? Okay. It's really not that complicated as far as a layperson's understanding goes. Let's suppose I'm on a train. And that train is going 50 miles an hour. So I'm standing here. And you're standing here. When that train goes past, it's going 50 miles an hour. I'm going 50 miles an hour. You're standing here. Now suppose I throw a baseball at 50 miles an hour. When that baseball goes past me, how fast is it going?
I haven't gotten there yet.
Well, you know, let's suppose it's
picking up speed.
Let's suppose it's not picking up speed. It's going 50 miles an hour. And it's going 50 miles an hour.
It's
how fast is the baseball going?
Hour, wasn't it?
Next, with respect to me. Sorry. With respect to you, if you're standing here.
Oh, okay.
How fast is that baseball going? 100 miles an hour. It's going 100 miles an hour. Yeah. If this is going past me at 50 miles an hour, and you're throwing a ball which is going faster than this. For the person who's standing here, that ball is going this speed plus that speed. I mean, if you think about it, it makes sense, right? Because it has to be going faster because it's moving faster than this car, which I've seen is going 50 miles an hour. You happy with that? If you're not happy with that, you're really lost. So, everyone happy with that? If you're not, speak up.
I'm not.
Okay. I thought somebody was. How can I explain it? Okay. Here I am walking past Jake. I'm going that fast, right? Now I'm walking past her, and I throw that thing.
Okay.
That thing is already moving as fast as I'm going.
Okay.
And then when I throw it, it's going the speed I'm going plus the speed I threw it at. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's okay.
Same idea here.
Okay, thank you.
This thing, the ball is already going 50. So when I throw it, and by my standing still, so when I throw it 50, it's going the speed I'm going, which is already going, plus the speed I added to it, which is 100. Okay? Now, it gets a little silly, but let's suppose the train is going 100,000 miles per second. And I'm standing here and I throw the ball at 100,000 miles per second. And somebody standing here, when that ball goes past, how fast is it going?
200,000.
You would think 200,000. Not a second. No, it doesn't. Anyone know how fast it really is going?
Can only go the speed of light.
Cannot go faster than the speed of light. 186,000. How is that possible? I've just violated the very law I established with my baseball analogy. That's the difference between nuclear, Newton's physics and Einstein's physics. But where's the catch? There is a catch. It's a big catch.
The time?
It's time. The time, the clocks running on this train are literally running at a different speed than here. So if I'm standing here and I'm going 100,000 miles a second and I throw the ball, I see the ball going at 100,000 miles a second. The person standing here cannot see the ball going any faster than the speed of light. And the difference is the speed is the rate of change per time. The time actually changes. Distance per time, like miles per hour, right? That's speed. Time has changed. That's the big deal. Time is not an absolute.
You're saying time on the train is going faster than the person.
Slower.
It's going slower than the person looking at it.
Yeah. So literally, if you get on a, and then they've measured these things, I mean, we're talking, this is such an astronomical speed that, you know, nobody can approach it, but they have put clocks on jumbo jets and sent them around the world, and they can literally measure the difference in time from a clock on that jet when it lands and the clock on the Earth. They set two clocks, put one on the jet, around the world, 10 times, however fast they go, speed of sound, whatever. They come back. It'll be a teensy, it'll be like 1/1000th of a second. These differences are so small that nobody saw them before. But they take absolutely accurate clocks. That clock that has been going around the world has run slower. So the time will be earlier when it lands. It makes no logical sense. Don't try to understand it. It's just a fact. Time is relative. So in theory, you know, if you could send somebody at the speed of light, see, the speed of light, time goes to infinity. Time is infinitely slow. So you could send somebody at the speed of light to another planet and back. For them, it would be 20 years. For us, it might be a second. And they've had all this experience, but they haven't aged. We wouldn't have aged. It's crazy. But it's scientific fact.
That feels like a lot like a synchronous event.
Well, you see, what it does, it shows us that time isn't absolute. This is the beginning, reason I pointed this out, it's the beginning of the breakdown of the old paradigm that time is absolute. Because what happens in a synchronicity is it seems that time has done something strange. And it used to be, in the old Newtonian world, that 5 plus 5 equals 10, but here 10 plus 10 doesn't equal 200 anymore. It's an opening in the door that says these things cannot happen. Because apparently time is such that it's not trying to establish that this proves that anything can happen. But the world isn't this predictable tick-tick that we once thought. So Einstein is really the first in the breakdown of cause and effect. Pauli was very fascinated with this. The same challenge to the old worldview of cause and effect is going to come much more strongly with quantum physics. But and this was like 1905, 1960. First theory was 1905. I think the second theory was 1916. This was developed in 1905. And 1916 theory was about gravity. I don't really understand that too well. But the in science, the beginning of the collapse of the old order was beginning in 1905. And Pauli was very impressed by this. We won't get into this too much with respect to Einstein, but just to play with it for a second, if you're interested. How many coordinates do you need in this, let's go back, in this old system, how many coordinates do you need to locate that ball?
Three.
You need to tell me how far it is off the ground. You need to tell me how far it is this way. And you need to tell me how far it is that way. Trinitarian. How many coordinates do you need to tell me where that ball is if it's going 100,000? Four. The three spatial and the one time. See, we've gone from a three to a four. 20 years before that, Nietzsche said, the Trinitarian God is dead. 25 years after Nietzsche said that, Einstein said Trinitarian space is dead. I think there's a parallel. What we're seeing in both our way of thinking in our view of matter is a shift towards a new dimension. Another way you could put what we're doing in this course is asking ourselves, what will life look like when we really live four and not just three? 3 to 4 is going to get another challenge in quantum physics, but this is the first challenge it gets. 3 will not describe the world adequately, and that's why it is no longer called space in Einsteinian physics, but space-time. Because space and time are interrelated. The length of a thing depends on how fast it's going. Doesn't make sense, but that's the case. Normally this never is an issue, as I said, because the speeds are so high.
Is this the one that has the E equal MC?
That's the implication of this, right. The other might be interesting just to mention. Are you interested in this?
Mm-hmm.
How all this started. It's so amazing how, I'm doing this a little bit to establish an analogy. I think I got this right. I don't know if you know this or not, but check me if you do. Here's the Earth. Here's the Sun. I think... say this is the planet Mercury. Everything made sense that Newton had. We'll talk about Newton and all this stuff. Newton's the guy who developed the ideas these guys overturned. Everything made sense, except for this one little stupid fact. That at a certain moment in the orbit of Mercury, according to the calculations, which explained everything in the universe, Mercury was predicted to be here, but in fact it was here. By like 1/1000 or 1/10000 of a degree, but certainly within the range of accurate measurements. And they couldn't understand why there was that little blip. Anybody figure out what the rub might be?
Time.
How did it work? Actually, it's gravity. The light coming from where they thought it would be, doesn't go like this, it's bent. No, it's not reflected, it's literally bent. That's the second law of Einstein. That light is bent in the gravitational field. No one had figured that out before. Einstein didn't solve that problem with the theory of first theory of relativity, but he was working on this issue, and then later realized that everything that we realized about space and time and length also applies to gravity. Let's not worry about gravity. But the point I wanted to make is how a teensy little error overturned everything. And my analogy would be, that's what synchronicity is. Synchronicity is that teensy little tenth of a thousandth of a degree, which doesn't quite fit, but it exists. And if we allow ourselves to take that fact as a starting point, we'll realize how inadequate the existing model is. And then that's what we'll be doing, is seeing how the unconscious is trying to construct a model to put in that fact. Just like everything had to be overturned to put in that little bit of a degree of light, of the shift of Mercury. So that's Einstein. Over to page 5. This guy Minkowski, I'm not going to get into him, but he was one of the guys who, if you come across the name, who developed the mathematics to figure all this stuff out. I don't think we need to worry about that. But the main point there on page 5 is how Pauli was entrusted with the responsibility to write a critique of Einstein's theory at the age of 21. And what Einstein said in response, which is, anyone studying this mature and important work would find it hard to believe that the author is a man of 21. One wonders what is to most admire, the psychological appreciation for the development of ideas, or the reliability of the mathematical deduction, the deep insight, the ability of clear systematic interpretation, knowledge of the literature, the factual completeness, the trustworthiness of the criticism. And one more thing, and then we'll stop. Just the next little paragraph, that Pauli mentions how this new physics was a shock to everything he had learned. And what we've done now, we've taken us through Einstein. Next week we'll pick up with next time we'll pick up with Bohr, and how this revolution in physics, which we're going to see as the seismograph for a revolution in our general worldview, went through Einstein in the macro view of things, and now started happening in the electron in the micro view of things. Yeah. See, what we've said here is that what you perceive depends on how fast you are going with respect to the thing you're looking at. So yes, it broke down the objectivity of the observer. Absolutely. He was the first. You see why he said that? Because time means your time, if you're going very fast, is different from somebody else's time that's not going very fast. And that difference in the relationship between the observer and the observed has to be figured in understanding what the thing is that the observer is seeing. So that perceptions are relative to the perceiver. Now with Einstein, you can still calculate that. With quantum, you can't calculate that anymore. And interesting, Einstein, who introduced the idea, would not accept that the physics idea was, the atom idea was final. They were all friends, of course, but Bohr and Einstein and Pauli never agreed. But I guess, did I tell you the story about Einstein and the tobacco? There's a story that Pally tells. Because, you know, when Pally was in Princeton for the war, during the duration of the war, they shared offices. And I guess he was in his office one day, and I think it was Niels Bohr was visiting, or somebody was visiting. And Einstein snuck in and stole some of Pally's tobacco. And Pally then caught him stealing tobacco, and he said, "What are you doing?" And Einstein said, "Well, my doctor said I'm not supposed to buy tobacco anymore, but he didn't see I couldn't steal it." I'll see you in 2 weeks.